Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 522, titled The Safari Club, subtitled Fifth Column Part 6, being recorded on August 14th of the year 2005. We're going to jump right in with the text from a remarkable new book called Prelude to Terror by Joseph Trento, an excellent book about the intelligence community and one that gets a Dave Emery 5-star rating. Now, the major focal point of this broadcast is the Safari Club. That is a Saudi-based, privatized, outsourced intelligence network that in many ways subsumed the CIA while at the same time functioning as an outgrowth of the CIA. Privatization and outsourcing are two of the going words and going concepts these days. That has been true of intelligence. And in this case, the privatization slash outsourcing of U.S. intelligence was directly reflective of and an outgrowth of some profound politico slash economic relationships deriving from the petroleum industry, specifically the Bush family's involvement with that and the Saudis' involvement with that. Two of the key players in this were the elder George Bush and also Prince Turki, the chief of Saudi intelligence, the man who ran Osama bin Laden for decades, including the entire time when Osama bin Laden was working for the Western intelligence apparatus against the Soviets and afterward. Note that Prince Turki resigned his position as intelligence chief shortly before September 11th, a little less than 2 weeks before that. He is now Saudi ambassador to the United States, now headed up by the elder George Bush's son. So the Safari Network, very, very, very much on the scene today, or the residua of that. What we're going to take a look at now is how the Safari Network and the Afghan Mujahideen effort against the Soviets led directly to the formation of Al-Qaeda and how it facilitated Al-Qaeda's operations against the United States. Note that a number of officials within the U.S. intelligence apparatus had warned that we had been backing the wrong elements in Afghanistan, basically that we were backing elements that, although they hated the Soviets, hated us as much or more, and that they would turn on us. That, of course, has happened. Turning once again to Joseph Trento's Prelude to Terror, we read, a year before the good folks at the CIA's Afghan desk popped open the champagne in celebration of the Soviet pullout, Osama bin Laden planned his move into the vacuum that would follow the end of the war. Bin Laden's goal was not just victory in Afghanistan, but a worldwide jihad against the West, a jihad that would engulf his home country and wash the entire region clean of the influence of the crusading infidels, unquote. The Saudi royal family continued to believe that throwing money at military and social problems would secure the family's future and access to the kingdom's petrodollars. But the Saudis' compromise with the Wahhabi mullahs had radicalized several generations of Saudis. The increasingly angry populace, deprived of any serious share of the oil wealth, watched helplessly as average annual incomes were cut in half from a high of $13,000 in 1981 to $6,000 by 2003. As with the last years of the peacock throne in Iran, the CIA, reliant on the Saudi GID and the Pakistani ISI for regional intelligence, did not warn the president of the danger ahead. When the Defense Intelligence Agency recommended that the Saudis needed to be monitored because they were funding terrorists, the DIA was told to discontinue all eavesdropping operations targeting the kingdom, according to the DIA official in charge of the program, who wishes to remain anonymous. Parenthetically, it is this Safari Club network and its operations with the Afghan Mujahideen that permitted the infiltration of some of these Wahhabi slash Muslim Brotherhood slash Al-Qaeda related elements into the United States. Note that later on this side, we're going to take a look at E-Systems in Dallas, Texas. That was the company that originally had the patents, or for a long time had the patents to Project HARP, and they trafficked some of the most secret CIA eavesdropping technology to the Saudis. And in many ways, I think we can see here something of a prelude to the development of PTEC. PTEC was a high-tech company funded basically by the Muslim Brotherhood, Yassin al-Qadi, elements associated with the Blind Sheikh in New York, elements associated with Bank al-Taqwa, and it was PTEC that developed the threat assessment software architecture for both the FAA and the United States Air Force, as well as for other federal agencies, including the Department of Energy, which oversees nuclear power plants. And that, I think, in many ways needs to be explored in order to get a handle on some of the anomalous performance of air defense units on September 11th. Basically, when you have outgrowths of this safari club associated with the Muslim Brotherhood developing the threat assessment software architecture for the FAA and the Air Force, it shouldn't be too surprising when those agencies behave in an anomalous fashion on September 11th. Returning once again to Prelude to Terror by Joseph Trento. CIA officials were blind to the flaws of their Saudi benefactors. It had gotten so extreme that the CIA station chief, starting in the 1980s, actually protected the head of Saudi intelligence, Prince Turki, and the GID and the Interior Ministry from the FBI on criminal matters. The CIA insulated the kingdom from the United States' own law enforcement officials. When a shy and religious Osama bin Laden went to Kabul to, quote, help, unquote, it is not surprising that men like CIA officer Milton Bearden, quote, did not pay much attention to bin Laden, unquote. By giving him an intelligence portfolio with a GID operating in Pakistan and Afghanistan, the Saudis let a man in the tent who brilliantly exploited the opportunity by recruiting among the Wahhabis. As success came to bin Laden, the GID allowed him more and more scope, including recommendations for recruitment for the GID and Interior Ministry. Bin Laden was positioned to do enormous damage to the Saudi kingdom and to the United States. Because the CIA had effectively given up independent recruitment in the region, the United States was operating without a safety net, without the ability to detect someone like bin Laden commandeering the anti-Soviet cause. Quote, you were relying on two intelligence services, the Saudi GID and the Pakistani ISI, to act in the United States' best interest without any ability to verify their promises or their work, unquote, a high-level CIA official said. Quote, that is what the agency had become, simply a group of bureaucrats writing checks. We had no control over what was being done with the money, and we deliberately ignored danger signs, and there were plenty. Quote, to make matters worse, the official continued, the CIA permitted U.S. Customs at Dulles Airport to overlook an illegal export of our most secret eavesdropping software to Saudi Arabia, unquote. The software, referred to as Keyword Software, is a computer code developed for the National Security Agency by a company called E-Systems. The software allows keywords and phrases to be flagged by computers from targeted voice and other communications in real time. The problem with exporting the software is that any country getting it could use it to target U.S. interests and allies. It could even be used to track what U.S. law enforcement, military, and intelligence agencies were doing. Lewis Sams, the man E-Systems ordered to deliver the software to the kingdom, said, quote, I was very nervous when I got to the airport. I knew it was illegal to take it out of the country, but I was given the name of a customs official at Dulles Airport and told if there were any problems to ask for him. E-Systems' desire to do business with the royal family was why I thought they sent me, unquote. Sam said that E-Systems, which had close ties to the White House, maintained the secret communications gear for Air Force One. As it turned out, E-Systems did not get the contract for Saudi intelligence, but the software was left with GID officials even so, according to Sams. And again, I think we can see in this, interrupting here, something of a paradigm for the development ultimately of PTEC, in which you had basically al-Taqwa, the Muslim Brotherhood, the al-Qaeda milieu, developing the threat assessment software for the Air Force and the FAA. Note here that the shipping of this keyword software from the NSA, courtesy of E-Systems to Saudi Arabia, would allow them to monitor what we were doing. Again, a key element of the Fifth Column that operated on September 11th and, in my opinion, is operating still. Continuing. What Joseph Trento goes on to talk about now is that when you privatize intelligence, it neutralizes the ability of counterintelligence, namely monitoring / spying on your allies in order to make sure they are not actually your enemies. Continuing. Among the problems with using a private intelligence network is that the benefits of counterintelligence are not available. And if your private network is essentially funded by another country, you are flouting a basic tenet of intelligence. Trust no one, including your allies. The purpose of counterintelligence is to test the veracity and honesty of sources and allies, and to protect secrets. When an illegal network of private businesses and secret alliances carries out a nation's covert operations, counterintelligence is not possible. In the early 1990s, the cost of not having any counterintelligence capability would soar. The absence of counterintelligence became a growing problem as the United States relied more and more and more on proxy intelligence operations through other countries and private organizations. The lack of vetting of those involved in Iran, Contra, and Saddam's regime, and finally, in those who supplied the George W. Bush administration with false intelligence on Iraq, all demonstrate how devastating the lack of a counterintelligence capability can be. In the tumultuous times of 1988 and 1989, a handful of second-guessers and naysayers, unquote, at the CIA warned that the country had allied itself with the wrong people in Afghanistan, but they were not being listened to. The idea that our closest allies in Afghanistan would turn against us was not even given consideration. When Osama bin Laden attended events in Kabul in support of the Mujahideen, his presence raised no curiosity in the U.S. intelligence community. Reports on bin Laden were neither critical nor probing. The relationship between the new president and the bin Laden family was no secret at the CIA, and they cozily assumed Osama was on our side. For the CIA to miss the scale of the Saudi-funded Pakistani nuclear weapons program is an example of the woeful intelligence produced by the CIA during this period. But missing the transformation of Osama bin Laden from the shy son of one of the most prominent families in Saudi Arabia to the leader of a terrorist network supported by ISI and GID officials in Pakistan and Afghanistan was pure operational negligence. In many ways, bin Laden represented the penultimate compromise of the House of Saud. While half of the royal family recognized the need to do business with the West, the other half felt uncomfortable with the ways of the West. The initial intelligence failure took place in 1979 and 1980 when the CIA failed to see the connection between bin Laden and hundreds of his family's construction workers and heavy equipment operators moving into the Afghan war zone at the same time that the GID dispatched there the most charismatic Muslim leader of the time, Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood leader Abdallah Azzam. Azzam joined forces with bin Laden in opening a recruiting center, the Maktab al-Khidmat, or MAK, Services Office. Though this was all fully known to the CIA, the agency's regional experts asked no questions. Amazingly enough, no one in the CIA's Afghan operation even asked why a Palestinian leader had suddenly turned up in Afghanistan. CIA money was actually funneled to MAK since it was recruiting young Muslim men to come join the jihad in Afghanistan. This information comes from a former CIA officer who actually filed these reports. We can't identify him here because at the time of the writing of this book, he was back in Afghanistan as a private contractor. Azzam, a Palestinian by birth, had been forced years before to flee to Jordan and then to Saudi Arabia. In Peshawar, Azzam, funded by bin Laden and the GID, opened the Office of Services of the Holy Warriors, or Mujahideen. Azzam's message was clearly anti-Israeli and anti-American. And yet, bin Laden's opening MIK branch offices in the United States, Europe, and Asia was applauded by the CIA. The agency never suspected that bin Laden might have had bigger plans in Afghanistan. While bin Laden paid for the transportation of the new fighters to the war zone, the Saudi network of charities helped take care of their families. Bin Laden's army was one of seven major Mujahideen armies supported by the CIA's $500 million a year program. After the victory over the Soviets, many of the Islamic warriors went home. They took with them the kind of confidence that can be gained only by helping to take out a greatly superior force. Bin Laden recognized that their experience and radicalism could change the face of the Islamic world. He kept the Mujahideen training camps in Afghanistan in operation and expanded his efforts by spreading the holy war to Somalia, Bosnia, Kosovo, the Philippines, and Chechnya. The network was spreading, And despite subsequent denials, there is incontrovertible evidence that the CIA's knowledge was far deeper than it has been willing to admit. An American consular officer in Saudi Arabia discovered firsthand that the CIA was allowing Afghan, quote, freedom fighters, unquote, to get visas to come to the United States during and after the Afghan War. Michael Springman, now a lawyer in Washington, D.C., was then an officer in the U.S. consulate in Jeddah. Springman repeatedly confronted his bosses about their approval of questionable visa applications. At first, Springman suspected that one of his bosses was corrupt and was selling visas to people who would never normally be admitted to the United States. Springman pushed so hard for answers that he was eventually warned to just do what he was told. Quote, "In Saudi Arabia, I was repeatedly ordered by high-level State Department officials to issue visas to unqualified applicants. I complained bitterly at the time. I returned to the U.S. I complained to the State Department here, to the General Accounting Office, to the Bureau of Diplomatic Security, and to the Inspector General's Office. I was met with silence." As Springman kept pushing for an explanation, his fitness evaluation became more critical of him, and he was eventually dismissed. It took him years to find out that Jeddah was the center of the GID/CIA recruiting operation. Springman said he should have been suspicious even before he was first sent to Jeddah. Quote, "I had gotten some strange questions before I went out to Jeddah from the then ambassador, Walter Cutler, who kept talking about visa problems. He said how I should do my best to make sure that everything ran smoothly. Once I got there, I found I was being ordered to issue visas to people who really should not have gotten a visa. I'll give you just one example. There were two Pakistanis who wanted to go to an American trade show in the United States. They claimed they were going with a Commerce Department-sponsored trade mission. These guys couldn't name the trade show, and they couldn't name the city in which it was being held. When I refused the visa after a couple of minutes of questioning, I got an almost immediate call from a CIA case officer hidden in the commercial section of the consulate that I should reverse myself and grant these guys a visa. I told him no. Not long afterwards, he went to the chief of the consular section and got my decision reversed. This was exactly contrary to normal operating procedures. Essentially, in the State Department, the guy doing the interviewing has the first, last, and usually the only word regarding visa issuances. He can be reversed if it was not done according to regulation, for example. If somebody comes up with additional information that's material, you can push for a change in the petition. But this was one of a pattern. Week after week after week, and they got more brazen and blatant about it. And I was told on occasion, well, you know, if you want a job in the State Department in the future, you will change your mind. And other people would simply say, you can change your mind now, or wait until the Consul General reverses you. I learned later it was basically the CIA that had Osama bin Laden recruiting people for the Afghan War and taking them to the U.S. for terrorist training, unquote. In 1988, Abdallah Azzam and Osama bin Laden founded the secret organization later known as Al-Qaeda. One more time, because this sentence is critical. Note that this is 1988. That's before the end of the Afghan War and during the time that elements of our intelligence community outsourced and privatized to the CIA, to the Safari Network embracing the elder George Bush and Prince Turki. This is before that war ended, but already the storm clouds are gathering here. In 1988, Abdallah Azzam and Osama bin Laden founded the secret organization later known as Al-Qaeda. The purpose of the organization was to continue the jihad beyond the victory over the Soviets. Members swore a blood oath to do this. Quickly, however, Azzam began to complain that the movement was not ready to go outside of Afghanistan until it secured a homeland for the Palestinians. Bin Laden had already allied himself with Saeed Ramadan's branch of the Muslim Brotherhood and was looking at change far beyond Afghanistan. He essentially ignored the Palestinians. The arguments between bin Laden and Azzam ended in late 1989 when Azzam died in a car bombing. While some Afghan fighters believe that bin Laden and the Pakistani ISI were directly responsible for the car bomb that killed Azzam, Saudi intelligence sources concluded that Israeli intelligence had assassinated the Palestinian leader after being tipped off about his movements. However, they do suggest that bin Laden was the source of the information passed on to Mossad through the CIA in Kabul, or Kabul, excuse me, in Afghanistan. So again, note this privatized intelligence network that ultimately led to the genesis of al-Qaeda and that constituted, through these relationships themselves, reflective of and growing out of profound political slash economic relationships, this in many ways set the stage for the fifth column, which manifested itself in a deadly way on September 11th. But also note, as I've said in many broadcasts, that this is the events in and around September 11th are an extremely, it's an extremely complex event, and one not to be oversimplified. Many people have suggested that September 11th was a provocation. Looked at in many ways, that would appear to be the case. However, that is at best an oversimplification. Frankly, I don't think it's true. This is a much, much more complicated scenario and much, much worse. What I would suggest, first of all, in terms of getting a handle on this admittedly very, very complex event, is to examine the history not only of fascism but of fifth columns. I would compare what took place on September 11th with the subversion of France in the run-up to and during World War II. In, among other broadcasts, FTR 367 and 441, I compared the economic relationships between elements of the French power elite and their German counterparts, and how those economic relationships plus ideological affinities between the power elites of France and Germany, allied through economic and business relationships, were similar. They were afraid of democracy. They were afraid it would lead to communism. And the French power elite were in many ways far more afraid of elements of their own population, particularly Democrats with a small d, as well as socialists and Marxists. And in order to basically eliminate democracy in France, they collaborated with the invaders. And again, For the Record programs 367, I believe it's 367, it might be 366, but I believe it was 367. You can certainly check that out using the search function on the Spitfire website, but certainly in For the Record program 441, I accessed, among other works, some material from the book Triumph of Treason by Pierre Coe. Pierre Coe was the French Minister of Aviation under the Social Front, or the Popular Front, of Léon Blum in the 1930s, and after the abortive fascist coup in France in 1938, he, among others, was taking stock of how the coup plotters did not abandon their efforts at eliminating French democracy. If you go to the description for the Record Program 441, there's a long excerpt from Triumph of Treason by Pierre Coe, describing in no uncertain terms how elements of the French power elite were fully aware that Germany was going to invade. They actively subverted the French military resistance to the German invasion because they saw that as the best way of getting rid of the Republic and eliminating democracy and bringing fascism to France. And of course, that is exactly what happened. Ultimately, genuine French patriots were put on trial by the Vichy fascist collaborationist government and charged with subverting France, whereas they were actually the true patriots who had defended France. The traitors took the patriots and put them on trial for treason against France. And even though, again, elements of the French power elite were fully aware of the impending German invasion, collaborated with it because they were much more concerned with maintaining their economic privilege and also their relationships with their fascist German counterparts, it should be noted that the invasion of France by Germany in World War II was not a provocation. The Wehrmacht, the Luftwaffe, the Kriegsmarine, and the Waffen-SS weren't French agents provocateurs. And it sure as bloody hell was not an act intended to promote French empire. I would suggest that the United States is in no size, shape, form, or manner the beneficiary of September 11th, although certain corporate interests are. The same was true in France. Many, many French corporations benefited handsomely from collaboration with the German war effort in World War II. But again, the German invasion of World War II wasn't a French provocation. Also, we should note in examining history that it is not unusual for allies to turn into deadly enemies. Perhaps the most striking recent example of that was the German-Soviet alliance in World War II. The pact between Hitler and Stalin ultimately led to the division of Poland between invading German and invading Soviet armies, but ultimately that pact dissolved into one of the bloodiest and most lethal conflicts of all time. And again, the Red Army and the Red Air Force and the Soviet Navy were not German agents provocateurs, and likewise, again, the Wehrmacht, Waffen-SS, Luftwaffe, and Kriegsmarine weren't Soviet agents provocateurs as well. The Eastern Front in World War II was not a provocation either by the Soviets or the Germans. And I would suggest that and the situation in France during World War II as analogies, albeit admittedly imperfect ones. Again, this is a complex event. In analyzing the fifth column that we're talking about here as well, do not overlook the material presented in, among other broadcasts, For the Records 498 and 499, because there are underground Reich elements here in a big, big way. I would note that SECO, the Saudi investment company, the European-based holding company for the fabulously wealthy bin Laden family's European interests, was deeply involved first in the Afghan Mujahideen support effort and then in some of the Iran-Contra-related covert operations, including drug smuggling. One of the principal figures involved in those operations was Baudin Dunant, an influential lawyer who is not only a close friend of and a protege of, and also the attorney for, the late François Genoux, a key Axis spy, an individual who, in, among other programs, for the record 453, is described in detail. François Genoux was one of the most important Third Reich operatives deeply involved with Middle Eastern interests, and also the heir to the literary works and last will and testament of Adolf Hitler, Martin Bormann, and Joseph Goebbels, and Baudin Dunant, a key operative in SECO and many of the operations of the Safari Club, one of many underground Reich elements. Now, admittedly, the format that I'm using here on For the Record, at least most of the programs, the interviews aside, is a very, very pedantic format, consequently difficult for a lot of people to absorb. This effort here began more than a quarter of a century ago, and new media have evolved, principally the Internet. Please take advantage of the Internet, because those of you who only listen on the radio are missing an awful lot of the information. www.spitfirelist.com is a Spitfire website. Each For the Record show is turned into a long, written, article-length description, often containing text that I did not have time to include in the original broadcast. At the top of each description are numerous links, not only to other For the Record shows, but also to websites containing, among other things, the declassified government documents that demonstrate the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II. Tip of the hat to listeners in the Midwest for that. Websites containing both Adobe PDF and HTML versions of the pivotal Martin Bormann Nazi in Exile. There is a listener back east who's turning each For the Record show description into a blog spot, or basically a place on a blog spot. Links to two websites maintained by the heroic sister station WFMU-FM in Jersey City, New Jersey. More recent For the Record shows are available on streaming real audio and MP3 at www.wfmu.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory. Older shows available at a longer URL for download only. WFMU is also podcasting the For the Record show as well. There's also a search function on the Spitfire website and a page to click on for information about how to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like what you're hearing on this program, there's no better thing you can do about it than support the work that I'm doing. And many, many thanks to those of you who have. I just don't have time to write individual thank you letters, okay? That concludes For the Record program number 522, Side 2. It's titled The Safari Club, subtitled Fifth Column, Part 6. It's being recorded on August 14th of the year 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.